This morning we're going to continue the series that we're calling The Case for Faith, and it's based on that award-winning book that we've talked about for the last 3 or 4 weeks, written by Lee Strobel, who was once an atheist and now one of the strongest defenders of Christianity in our country today. And the book is called The Case for Faith, and we've ordered some more copies for you. Each week we order 10, 12, 18 copies, and by the end of the day they're gone. So I appreciate that. Many of you are taking these books, and many of you are reading through these chapters. And that's wonderful. That's going to augment the teaching that you're going to receive on Sunday morning. And the question that we're going to talk about today is addressed in chapter 3 of The Case for Faith. And it's simply, what about evolution? I mean, if evolution explains the origin and development of life, who needs God? Right? There's a lot of people that think that way. There are people that you know that think that way. Maybe some in here think that way. Charles Templeton thinks that way. Charles Templeton is an agnostic. He's 83 years old now, and he doesn't believe that there could be a God. He's not willing to say there isn't a God, but he's willing to say, I'm not sure, and I don't believe there is a God. One time, Charles Templeton stood in front of a church like this, only many times larger, and was a successful pastor. One time, he sat next to Billy Graham on the platform and helped teach and preach at Graham's Crusades. But then he lost his faith. And he wrote a book called Farewell to God. And in his book, he makes this statement: all of life is the result of timeless evolutionary forces. That's where he's at now. And in an interview with Strobel, he said he can't imagine how anybody with a reasonably good mind could believe in God. And that's the quote I want you to hear from his own lips on this slice of that interview.
The Case for Faith.
It seems to me that anyone with a reasonably good mind cannot look with open eyes at the evidence of a world which is filled with horrors. Animals eating animals, humans killing humans. And there is supposed to be someone who is all powerful, who could change it. It is impossible for me to believe that there is any one thing, person, being, whatever, that could be described as a loving God who could allow what happens in our world daily. And I am doomed. The question then is, are you doomed by God? Well, if there was a God, one, I suppose, could say so, but there isn't a God, so no. A person has faith and they feel good about it and it makes them a better person, then I'm for that person, even though, in my view, they're dead wrong.
Dead wrong. That's a pretty powerful statement. According to Charles Templeton, those of us who believe in God are dead wrong. He's a great thinker. He's not the only one with a great mind who thinks that believers in God are dead wrong. The late Carl Sagan was an astronomer. He was an astrophysicist. He was a professor at Harvard University. He was an author. He wrote a number of books, Contact and Cosmos. And in his book Cosmos that he wrote back in 1980, Carl Sagan had this to say: the cosmos, or the universe, is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. If we must worship a power greater than ourselves, does it not make sense to revere the sun and the stars? That quote's not only found in that book. That quote, believe it or not, is inscribed on a plaque in the Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Carl Sagan didn't believe in God either. When he looked at the sky at night, he didn't say, God, you are awesome. When he looked at the sky at night, he said, Cosmos, you are awesome. And I worship you. Today, the theory of evolution, which some call Darwinism, is widely accepted as the origin of life. It's rampant throughout our educational system. It starts in elementary school, it goes all the way through graduate school, and it's taught on every level across the board with varying degrees of conviction. In chapter 3 of The Case for Faith, Lee Strobel, who was most of his life an atheist, and has since become a Christian, says this: I lost the remnants of my faith in God during biology class in high school. So profound was the experience that I could take you back to the very seat where I was sitting when I first was taught that evolution explained the origin and development of life. The implications were clear to me. Charles Darwin's theory eliminated the need for a supernatural creator by showing how natural forces could account for the increasing complexity and diversity of living things. Lee Strobel had his faith torpedoed in high school when he first heard of evolution. The stakes are high. He's not the only one. Patrick Glynn is a Harvard scholar who for many years of his life was an atheist and has since become a Christian. But in reflecting back on this subject, this is what Glynn had to say. He said, I embraced skepticism at an early age when I first learned of Darwin's theory of evolution in, of all places, my Catholic grade school. It immediately occurred to me that either Darwin's theory was true or the creation story of Genesis was true. They could not both be true. And I stood up in class and I told the poor nun just that. Thus began a long odyssey away from the devout religious belief and practice that had marked my childhood toward an increasingly secular and rationalistic outlook. Grade school. Parochial grade school. In our culture today, the case for evolution is considered by most people to be nailed down shut. I mean, that's what Time magazine thinks. In the last issue of the last millennium, December 31st, 1999, Time magazine devoted their whole issue to reflecting on the last 1,000 years. And when they came to science, this is what was written in Time magazine. Charles Darwin didn't want to murder God, as he once put it, but he did. Darwinism remains one of the most successful scientific theories ever promulgated. Richard Dawkins is a professor at the prestigious Oxford University in England. Richard Dawkins speaks for many people when he says this: Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Evolution is a popular scientific theory today. It's embraced by many without question. But it's still only a theory. And that's what we need to remember. And recently, more and more biologists and biochemists and researchers, Christians and non-Christians alike, have raised serious objections to the evolutionary theory, claiming that its broad inferences are sometimes based on flimsy, incomplete, and flawed data. What once looked like an airtight case has begun to leak. New discoveries in the last 30 years have led an increasing number of scientists to contradict Darwin by concluding that there must be an intelligent designer behind the creation and development of life. And what you need to know today is no longer is this a debate between religion and science. It's not about pastors debating professors. This is an issue of science versus science. It's about professors debating professors. It's about PhDs disagreeing with PhDs. There is not uniform agreement in the scientific community over the legitimacy of evolution. And we need to know that. Things have shifted in our lifetime. Now, before we go any further, I want us all to get on the same page. I'm trying to make this as simple as I can, so simple that I could understand it. I want to start by defining some terms. First, I want to define the term evolution. Evolution means change in any direction. That's what you'll find if you look up the word in the dictionary. Evolution is not a bad word. And that change can be changed for the better or it can be changed for the worse. Technology is evolving. It's always changing. Valley View Community Church is evolving. It's growing and it's changing all the time. There's nothing wrong with the word evolution. All it means is change in any direction. Now, when you take that word out of the dictionary and plug it into a scientific context, it takes on two forms. The first form is called microevolution. Microevolution, and that describes the small micro changes that occur within a species. And in my reading this week, I discovered that most people, Christians and non-Christians alike, professors and pastors alike, would agree that microevolution has taken place in our world. Microevolution, change within a species, adaptation within a species, is the explanation, perhaps, for why there are 40 different brands of domestic cat, or why there are 200 different breeds of dog. It's not like on day one in creation, you know, God created every single breed of dog and cat. No, microevolution allows for changes within a species. And that's fine. We're not murdering God by accepting microevolution. But when we get to macroevolution, the stakes get a lot higher. Macroevolution describes the big changes that occurred, and this is critical, between species, not within species, but between species. Macroevolution is Darwin's theory. It's the theory that life as we now know it began millions, even billions of years ago with a simple, single-celled organism. Unidentifiable even by the human eye, that small. And over lots and lots of time, through natural processes, not through supernatural intervention, that single-celled organism evolved until we see what we do today in our world, a vast variety of both plant and animal life. Macroevolution caused the changes that took a single cell and turned it into amoeba and turned it into a monkey that became an ape that eventually became a man. That's macroevolution. There are over 20 variations of that theory, by the way. Even those who embrace evolution as a theory vary among themselves. But it all started with Darwin and his groundbreaking book in 1859, The Origin of Life. That's when he first published his theory. The evolutionary theory is based on a very simple equation. And the equation looks like this. Mutations plus natural selection plus time equals evolution. That's the equation. Let me explain each one of those elements. First of all, what is a mutation? A mutation is a variation or a change in an existing life form. That's what a mutation is. Natural selection is the process that weeds out weak organisms or ill-adapted creatures. It's also popularly described as the survival of the fittest. And time is what evolution needs a ton of. You see, because these changes didn't occur overnight. These changes all occurred over time. Most evolutionists would date the world to about 5 billion years old, and they have to, because they have to have all that time for that single-celled organism to develop into the complexity of human life. And to climb up that evolutionary ladder takes tons and tons of time. So time is critical in the evolutionary equation. Mutations plus natural selection plus time equals evolution. Now, I want to take a critical look at this. And again, this is not a pastor taking a look at this. This is scientists taking a critical look at the evolutionary theory. The first thing I want to talk about is mutations. Let's pull it apart one piece at a time. What about mutations? Geneticists agree that mutations are not a good thing. Mutations are a bad thing. 99.9% of all mutations are harmful. They don't strengthen a life form. They weaken a life form, and often they can be lethal to life. Mutations aren't good things. Mutations are bad things, 99.9% of the time. I don't need statistics to show me that. I just need to talk to parents who are expecting a baby. I have never talked to a parent who is praying that their child would be born mutated. I have never met a parent who said, pray with me that my child would be the next rung on the evolutionary ladder, that they would take us to the next life form beyond human beings. Parents don't pray that. I have 3 children of my own. We didn't pray that. Every parent I know prays that their child would be born healthy, would be born normal. And as soon as that baby comes out of the womb, you know what they do? They count the number of fingers and they count the number of toes. They're not saying, God, give my child 3 ears. Give my child 4 eyes. Give my child 6 fingers. Because mutations aren't good things. Mutations are bad things. Natural selection. Natural selection, as I described a moment ago, weeds out weak creatures and allows the strongest to survive. This was perhaps Darwin's most unique contribution to the theory of natural selection. But if natural selection weeds out weaker life forms, then it would weed out mutations, right? Because mutations are weaker life forms. But mutations are the very thing that evolution needs to keep climbing that ladder. And if natural selection is supposed to weed out lower life forms, then why do so many lower life forms still exist in our world? Why is the world still full of amoebas and single-celled organisms? Natural selection is a problem for the theory. Mutations are a problem for the theory. The fossil evidence, which was supposed to substantiate the theory of evolution, has failed miserably to show us the transitional life forms that occurred between species. A fossil is an imprint that is made into a layer of rock. Some of us in science class used to see fossils of ferns, you know, those impressions that were made in rocks. Well, they were supposed to produce the evidence that would prove that the evolutionary theory is true. But Darwin, even Darwin admitted, and I'm quoting here, that fossil evidence is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection to this theory. In one of his personal letters, Darwin wrote this: not one change of species into another is on record. We cannot prove that a single species has been changed. That was Darwin himself. What you got to understand about Darwin was that Darwin was a guy in process too. He didn't have this whole thing figured out. Over 100 years has passed since Darwin published his theory. That was 1859. 120 years after that, in 1979, the director of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, very well-respected museum, a fellow by the name of David Raup, said this: "We now are about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. We have fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time." Fossil evidence has been a major letdown for evolutionary thinkers. You know what the fossils do show? The fossils do show that some 570 million years ago, there was a sudden appearance of nearly all animal life fully formed without a trace of the evolutionary ancestors that Darwin's theory requires. Now, what about time? Evolution needs a lot of time. It needs time for life to develop, and it needs time for life to begin. Darwin lived way before the discovery of DNA. And DNA has not bolstered the theory of evolution. DNA has taken a huge shot at evolution because of the information that we are finding encoded on DNA. Darwin believed that life emerged from chemicals reacting in some warm little pond. And he thought that someday people are going to figure out how life came from non-life. He thought that was going to be something that would be solved. But you know what? We're 150 years after Darwin, and that problem still hasn't been solved. In fact, it's more daunting than ever before. Now, track with me on this one, because the statistics here can blow you away. Biologists now tell us that there are 10 to the 87th power. That's 10 with 87 zeros after it. That's a big number. There are 10 to the 87th power ways to put together a human DNA molecule. And according to evolution, that leaves God out of the equation, that molecule came together by chance over trial and error, over lots and lots of time. Well, if you believe that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, okay, that's a lot of time. You know how many seconds there are? Seventh power ways to put together a DNA molecule. So if you try to combination every single second to put together this DNA molecule by chance, there wouldn't be nearly enough time to do it, even in a world that's 4.5 billion years old. Lee Strobel's not a scientist. Lee Strobel's a journalist. Lee Strobel's a lawyer. He's got a legal mind. So he didn't attempt to write this chapter in his book on evolution. He went to the best mind he could find. He went down to Texas A&M University, and he went to a guy named Walter Bradley, Dr. Walter Bradley. Dr. Bradley's been teaching mechanical engineering at Texas A&M for 24 years. For 4 years, he's been the director of the Palomar Technology Center. He lectures widely around the country on the origin of life. He wrote a seminal book called The Mystery of Life's Origin, and he's the guy that Lee Strobel wanted to talk to about the evolutionary theory. And in a portion of that interview, Strobel asked him about this whole issue of time and chance. And given, you know, 5 billion years, could it be possible for life to have emerged from non-life? And in response to that question, this is what Walter Bradley had to say.
Before 1965, people believed in a steady state theory of the universe, which is to say the universe was infinitely old. And if the universe is infinitely old, then the improbable becomes probable. With the discovery of the background radiation in 65, the Big Bang Theory became dominant in people's thinking of cosmology. The bad news was that it meant the universe was no more than 12 billion years old. And more recent work has verified that the Earth is probably less than 5, and it would only have had a proper temperature to allow chemical reactions to begin between, say, 4.2 billion and when life appears to have first come on the scene in 3.8 billion. So that gives you about 400 million years. So now we don't have an infinite number of time. If you take all the carbon in the universe, put it on the face of the Earth, you allow it to chemically react at 10 to the 13th times per second, and allow that to happen for a billion years, which is twice the time we know we had, you come up with a probability of 1 in 10 to the 60th of making one functional protein in accidental chemical reactions. The probability of doing it in one reaction is 1 in 10 to the 130th. That's 10 with 130 zeros. If you say, well, but we have lots of chances, and we have lots of time, okay, with all the carbon in the universe reacting at the highest possible rate, so you get the maximum number of tries, the probability gets better. It's 1 in 10 to the 60th pair. It's still pretty horrendous. I haven't done simple calculations. It'd be like covering the state of Texas in quarters, I guess, you know, 10 feet deep and having one that's orange and trying to randomly reach down and pull out and come up with that. I mean, people make up metaphors like that, but it's so minuscule that it isn't scientific to believe that's how it happened. And I don't think people who work in the field for a moment believe that. They believe chance is not an adequate explanation for how life began.
I know that tape was somewhat muffled, but I wanted you to hear that last statement that he made. And I wanted you to know that it's backed up by the mind of a scientist who spends his life in the field. And the last thing he said is, chance is not an adequate explanation for how life began. No matter how much time you have. There are problems with the evolutionary theory. There always have been problems, and there always will be. And the more we learn, the more difficult it's becoming to embrace the theory. In fact, Bradley says this in another section of the quote. He says, I think people who believe that life emerged naturalistically need to have a great deal more faith than people who reasonably infer that there's an intelligent designer. You know what he's saying? He's saying it takes more faith to believe in the equation than it does to believe in a supernatural creator God. In fact, it takes so much faith, he said in the slice we listened to, that it's not even scientific. The biggest question left unanswered by Darwin and his evolutionary theory is, where did life come from in the first place? Where did that warm little pond come from where Darwin thought life began? There still has to be a beginning, and evolution has no answer for the beginning, even the beginning of non-life. Sir Francis Crick was one of the discoverers of DNA. He was a Nobel Peace Prize winner because of his achievement. And in a quote, this is what he said about the origin of life. Doesn't profess to be a believer, by the way. The origin of life appears almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to be satisfied to get it going. Every time I write a paper on the origin of life, I swear I will never write another one, because there's too much speculation running after too few facts. Walter Bradley, the man we just heard in the interview, said this: there isn't any doubt that science, for the moment at least, is at a dead end. The optimism of the 1950s is gone. The mood at the 1999 International Conference on the Origin of Life was described as grim, full of frustration, pessimism, and desperation. Evolution fails to answer the most fundamental question, which is, where did life come from in the first place? Somebody written up in that chapter of Strobel's book says, if you want to find an atheist to engage in a debate, you don't go to the physics department anymore. You got to go to the philosophy department, because there are not many atheists left in the physics department. At the end of his interview, Strobel asked Bradley, so you think the facts point convincingly toward a creator? Bradley said, oh no. He said, convincingly is too mild a term. The evidence is compelling. Convincing suggests it's little more likely than not. Compelling says that you have to really work hard not to get at that conclusion. Which is why, when other people look at the stars, they draw a radically different conclusion than Carl Sagan. Which is why, when David looked at the stars, he wrote in his book, Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Look up, and you will see evidence of God everywhere. People that travel into space and who are open to the idea of God inevitably have their faith strengthened. John Glenn, the first American astronaut, the first astronaut anywhere to orbit the Earth, returned to space back in 1998. After he came back on that second trip, this is what he said just a few years ago. Looking at the Earth from this vantage point, looking at this kind of creation, and to not believe in God, to me, is impossible. To see Earth laid out like that only strengthens my beliefs. The heavens declare the glory of God. One of the events I can remember as a child is sitting with my parents in what we called the middle room, the room in our house that had the TV, on a July night in 1969, and watching the lunar module land on the Earth's surface, and periodically running out of the room and going outside and looking up at the moon and saying, I can't believe it, there's people up there now, and then running in and back to the TV. And most of us who saw that event will never forget what Neil Armstrong said when he came down that ladder and he put his foot on the moon. You know what he said? He said, that's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. That's what everybody saw. That's what everybody heard. That's what everybody read in the newspaper the next day. But you know what happened just moments before that? You know what happened in the lunar module before the hatch opened? The first event that ever took place on the moon was the Lord's Supper. Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong pulled out a silver chalice and some pieces of bread and a little bit of wine. And together, 250,000 miles from home, nobody around except God, celebrated the Lord's Supper. I didn't see that on the news. I just found that out recently. Other great minds have looked at the same stars and said, the heavens declare the glory of God. James Tour is a nanoscientist at Rice University in Houston, Texas. A nanoscientist works with things that you can't even see. Nano means one billionth. That gives you an idea of the kinds of things this guy works on. In fact, when he's asked to describe his life, he says, I build molecules for a living. This is what he says. I love his quote. He says, I stand in awe of God because of what he has done through his creation. Only a rookie who knows nothing about science would say science takes away from faith. If you really study science, it will bring you closer to God. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Time magazine was wrong. Not the first time they were wrong. Darwin didn't murder God. God is alive and well. God is enthroned over his cosmos. And God is revealing himself to anybody who will notice that he is out there, that he is Lord of all creation, that he is the intelligent designer behind everything we see. The choice to believe that is ours. Not going to get any more evidence than that. Do you believe that? Let's pray. You are awesome. And the more we study, and the more that's revealed, and the more that scientists tell us, the more our faith grows. There is no other explanation, God. We're not going to worship the cosmos. We're not going to worship some warm little pond somewhere. We're not going to worship a single-celled organism that started this whole thing. We're going to worship you. You are Lord of all creation. You are the God of the heavens and the earth. And you deserve every bit of worship that we little human beings can give to you. And that's what we want to do right now. We want to lift you up. Tell you we love you. And thank you. Amen. Let's stand together and sing. Worship God.